It is Tuesday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, European opposition to the influx of migrants from the Middle East and Africa is growing. We'll bring you social media reaction to the Danish parliament passing a law to seize the valuables of incoming migrants. We'll also bring you an exclusive interview with Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins about the recent North Korean nuclear test and her thoughts about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. It's all ahead on International Edition. Polls show that support for anti-immigrant political parties in Germany has risen since hundreds of New Year's Eve attacks on women in the city of Cologne, apparently by groups of migrants. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports from the city on the wider impact on the debate over migration in Germany.
Sitting in a Cologne cafe, former English teacher Bashir Al-Zalan scrolls through photos on his phone of his escape from Syria. He says Germany has offered sanctuary, and the attacks on New Year's Eve filled him with anger.
Germany for the Syrians was some kind of mother, and at the head of that, Angela Merkel. I had fears after the incidents in Cologne, but after then I felt that the people just understand and they just don't have that kind of strategy that depends on action on reaction.
Al-Zalan wrote newspaper articles apologizing for the attacks on behalf of migrants and imploring locals not to blame all refugees. But the attacks have had political consequences. One poll showed support for the anti-immigration Alternative for Germany party has risen to an all-time high of 11.5%, putting it in third place. Hendrik Rottmann is head of the party's Cologne branch.
Nun, die Open Gate Philosophie von Angela Merkel.
Rottmann says that Chancellor Angela Merkel's open door philosophy has ensured that Germany has an unbelievable amount of migration and asylum seekers, of which some are refugees. But he says a large portion are unregistered, so no one knows what they are doing here. Of the 1.1 million migrants who came to Germany in 2015, 10,000 have settled in Cologne. The attacks have prompted some to question if so many newcomers can be integrated. Others claim that differing cultures cannot be mixed. Cologne authorities insist it can be done. Gregor Timmer is spokesman for the mayor.
Was den großen Teil der Flüchtlinge angeht, die nach Köln kommen, hier.
He says the vast majority of the refugees want to start a new life and integrate peacefully. That is a lot of work for Germans, he says, such as language courses, integration courses, and finding jobs. This is all relatively new, he adds. Early next month, hundreds of thousands of people are expected to line Cologne streets for the annual carnival. Groups of people are already out in costume.
We will see how Ausländer or wie auch immer auf uns zukommen.
This woman, dressed in a pirate outfit, says people in Cologne see more migrants are coming and are approaching it positively. But she says Germans are not going to let them take away our fun. She says this is our culture. Security is being heavily stepped up for the carnival. Cologne's authorities are aware any further attacks, like those on New Year's Eve, would have an impact far beyond the city's streets. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Cologne, Germany.
Well, it's time for us to check out what's trending online in social media, and we've got a bit of a role reversal today as Jim Stevenson joins us in the studio for that. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
Right, well, there's been a lot of controversy in Europe for months regarding the huge influx of immigrants and refugees, primarily fleeing from Syria and other conflict zones in the Middle East. One of the destination countries for those refugees has now enacted a law sparking a lot of debate. What's that about?
Well, Michael, the country is Denmark. Denmark expects to receive around 20,000 asylum seekers this year. That's compared with 15,000 last year. And on Tuesday, it approved a controversial migrant assets bill. Now, the government has said that the policy brings refugees in line with unemployed Danes who also face having to sell their assets above a certain level in order to claim benefits. Now, police say that they'll be able to seize valuables worth more than 10,000 kroner. That's about 1,300 euros and some change. You can do the math for your currency. Members of Parliament also extended the wait for migrants to apply for relatives to join them from 1 year to three. That's aimed at discouraging new arrivals, since so many are coming into the country. And temporary residence permits will be shortened, and the conditions for obtaining a permanent permit will be restricted.
Well, I can see why much of the reaction on social media to this has been negative, because you've got the prospect of refugees having possessions seized and that drawing, you know, leading to comparisons with the confiscation of valuables from Jews during World War II.
Absolutely, a bad memory there. A spokesman for UN Chief Ban Ki-moon criticized the decision, and human rights groups also expressing outrage. Here's a sampling of what I saw on Twitter. Salil Shetty writes, "Deeply disappointed to see hashtag Denmark vote for a cruel betrayal of hashtag refugees today." Teacher Dude writes, "One of the richest nations on earth passes a law allowing police to strip refugees of what they managed to bring from war zones." Irritated woman lives up to her name, writing, "Denmark passes law to seize valuables, cash from refugees. Welcome to Europe. Now give me that watch." Now, there are a small number of comments in the middle as well. Heger writes, "Will Denmark take money from refugees?" But this also happens in Germany, Switzerland, and Holland. And Michael, I'm sure there are, you know, some other comments as well that are on the negative side.
Right. Well, I think that's all of the time we have for now. But thanks so much, Jim, for that. You can follow Jim Stevenson on Twitter at VOA Stevenson. And you can also find our International Edition account on Twitter. It is at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
A love of history and a love of beer. Add that to an emphasis on sustainability, and you have the Heritage Brewing Company just outside Washington.
My name is Sean Arroyo. I'm the CEO of Heritage Brewing.
Arroyo and his brother started their brewery in 2013 with sustainability in mind. So they buy ingredients from local producers as much as possible.
Absolutely, yeah. Hop growing has actually kind of exploded in Virginia over the past couple years.
Heritage recycles much of the water used in the brewing process. It also reuses barrels from other breweries and distilleries.
Making sure that those barrels are being used, not just sitting out somewhere, you know, rotting away, is definitely something that's great in our industry.
And despite the expense, the brewery's environmental impact is an important consideration.
Organics are not cheap, there's no doubt. You know, it's a choice that you have to make to do what we see as the right thing, to spend more money.
Proving that sustainability can taste as good as it looks and sounds. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Well, there wasn't much political activity on Capitol Hill on Tuesday in Washington, with the federal government shut down for a second straight day as the U.S. East Coast recovers from a massive blizzard. But there was one U.S. senator on duty, Republican Susan Collins. Our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman caught up with her for an exclusive interview about North Korea's recent nuclear test and about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Bowman began by asking Senator Collins where she stands on a bill to approve the TPP trade deal, which is supported by President Obama.
I have not yet reached a decision on the TPP trade agreement. I remain concerned about the phase-out of duties on athletic footwear, which has a direct impact on 1,000 jobs in my state that are good manufacturing jobs. I also want to make certain that the environmental and labor standards are sufficient. For me, the question comes down to, is this a net plus for the state of Maine and the United States, or is it really just part of a strategy that the president has adopted to try to strengthen ties with certain Asian nations to try to counterbalance China's rising influence? And that's a legitimate goal for the president to have, but I'm more concerned about the impact on jobs in our country.
As a general rule, though, more trade is a good thing, correct?
Not necessarily, because if you're not operating on a level playing field, It can lead, and we've seen this over and over again, to trade imbalances that cost us good manufacturing jobs in this country. Maine recently has had countervailing duty suits from our paper makers because of China dumping on the American markets. Those can be very complex and expensive proceedings to kind of get to try to get the remedies that are available under our trade laws in time to save the jobs that are at risk. So I'm still in the undecided but dubious category.
Do we have any greater clarity about what exactly happened in North Korea and what should happen next?
From the discussions that I have had that have been non-classified, and I want to make that clear, it is still not a decided question of whether or not this latest test truly was of a hydrogen weapon and whether or not it represents a leap forward by the North Koreans or whether it was largely hype. Now, the presence of any nuclear weapons and the continuing testing of them in North Korea is a major concern. North Korea is already isolated from the entire world. There aren't additional sanctions that can be imposed. I would like to see China, which is North Korea's major benefactor, without which North Korea could not feed its people at all. Doesn't feed them very well as it is, but it could not feed them at all without Chinese help. Step up to the plate and tell the North Koreans that they need to halt their nuclear program.
There is a bill in the House that the Senate may be considering something. Is there any benefit to at least a statement?
Yes, there is. I mean, we can condemn. The United Nations Security Council has condemned the testing, but it doesn't really seem to do much good. I think you have to look at who has the influence on North Korea, and that is China.
Senator, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Senator Collins was speaking with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in the Chinese capital, Beijing, the last stop of his Asian tour. State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with the top U.S. diplomat and spoke from Beijing with VOA's Susan Yaki. Yaki asked Dawkins what Kerry has said about one issue likely to feature in his talks with Chinese officials, the maritime disputes in the South China Sea.
Well, although Kerry says the U.S. does not really take a side per se in the South China Sea dispute, the United States has been calling for a peaceful resolution for the territorial dispute. Kerry has said the item is on his agenda for Beijing. He's going to be meeting with officials, including the foreign minister and the prime minister. This is also an issue that he raised during his previous stops in Laos and Cambodia.
Is the tour in part in preparation for that meeting the U.S. is hosting that for the Southeast Asian leaders next month?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Laos is the current chair of ASEAN, and next month, President Obama is going to be hosting a special ASEAN summit in Sunnylands, California. And this meeting, this trip for Kerry, has been partly to lay the groundwork for that trip. Of course, there are economic and cultural ties that the U.S. is hoping to expand with both Laos and Cambodia, which are ASEAN members. And also, the meeting helped set the stage for Obama's visit to Laos later this year.
What is Obama expected to be dealing with when he goes to Laos later this year?
Well, he will be there for the full ASEAN meeting, and this will be, of course, an opportunity for the U.S. to look at expanding bilateral relations with all of the countries that are part of ASEAN, which has been an organization that the U.S. has been very supportive of.
Pam, perhaps you'll tell us about the highlights of Mr. Kerry's visit to Laos and Cambodia, although I know you've touched on this already.
Well, earlier today, the secretary started his day visiting a museum where items that had been looted during the war in Cambodia and then later sold and ended up in private collections, had been returned to Cambodia. Some of those items were returned from the United States. He also met with the country's prime minister and foreign minister. He raised human rights concerns and political rights concerns, which is a big issue in Cambodia. But he also said that during his talks, they looked at ways to explore economic ties and explore promotion of social programs. Kerry also met with an opposition leader and also met with some civil society members.
And that was our State Department correspondent, Pam Dawkins, speaking with Susan Yaki. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Monday marked the fifth anniversary of the Egyptian uprising that led to the ouster of longtime President Hosni Mubarak. In 2012, the following year, voters elected Islamist President Mohamed Morsi to succeed him. Morsi's turbulent rule ended with protests and his ouster by the army, led by current President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who has launched a harsh crackdown on Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood. Regional analyst Amin Saikal of the Australian National University told VOA's Victor Beatty that the revolution that brought Mr. Mubarak down has now come full circle.
It has come from an authoritarian rule to sort of a quasi-democracy, and then from quasi-democracy back to authoritarian rule. President al-Sisi has promised that he's going to deliver genuine democracy, but that remains to be seen. Quite a large number of opposition leaders, opposition activists, they are either in prison or they're under surveillance, or a good number of them have been killed, and also a good number of them, they're on death row. Just prior marking the fifth anniversary of the uprising, quite a number of opposition figures or those who've been suspected of opposition have been arrested and have been put in jail. At the moment, the situation does not really look promising as far as President Sisi's promise of transforming Egypt into a democratic state is concerned. I think that remains to be seen how the situation is going to pan out from this point.
The newly elected parliament, does that give you any hope of some trend toward democracy?
It really does not, because President Sisi's supporters will dominate this parliament, and therefore there will be little room for effective opposition. And so I think in many ways Egypt is going to be a sort of a one-party state as it was under President Mubarak. And of course we know that the Muslim Brotherhood has been declared as a terrorist organization and has been completely banned, and its leaders have been put in jail. Therefore, the Muslim Brotherhood will not be able to participate. But at the same time, I think other opposition groups have been very much dispersed and very much decimated in a lot of ways. So I think the parliamentary elections cannot really produce the kind of results which could really lead Egypt down the path of political pluralism, development of civil society, and all the other foundations which are necessary for transformation of a state from authoritarian rule or authoritarian sitting to a democratic sitting.
And that was regional analyst Amin Saikal speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. Time for some entertainment. A new film that tells the story of Nat Turner, an American slave who taught himself to read and then led a slave rebellion in 1831, has created a buzz at this year's Sundance Film Festival in Utah. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, The Birth of a Nation has people talking Oscars before it's even released to theaters.
Nate Parker took 7 years to write the screenplay for The Birth of a Nation. The film, in which Parker also stars and directs, tells the story of Nat Turner, a slave boy who learns to read and becomes a preacher in pre-Civil War Virginia. His masters hope that Turner's preaching will lead other slaves to be more subservient, so Nat is sent to other plantations to preach to the slaves. But his knowledge of the Bible and his exposure to the true misery of slavery soon lead Turner to encourage his fellow slaves to rebel against their masters. Nat Turner's rebellion left 60 slave owners and hundreds of slaves dead. Parker says that the film looks at the origins of issues that African Americans still have to deal with.
You know, my job as a filmmaker is to create content, to seek out material, to develop material that I think will help be progressive and deal with some of the systemic issues that we're dealing with. So to be able to write a project and then to go out and get it financed and attach talent and to go and shoot the movie and then to have Sundance recognize it and validate it and say this is something that we think is worth showing to the world and getting behind and sponsoring. I think that those are the steps that we need to take.
Armie Hammer, who plays Nat Turner's master Samuel, says that even though this is Parker's directorial debut, he ran the set like a seasoned veteran.
He showed up on the first day, and he wasn't shooting that day, but he showed up and he was in a suit, he had the tie on, and he walks and he's like, put that camera over there, put this lens on it, bring me a viewfinder with this lens, move that light 6 feet this way, and then you two stand on your mark and get over there, and bring me those two things, and blah, blah, blah. And, he walked on the set with the confidence and skill and ability of someone who's directed 50 movies before.
The film comes at a time when Hollywood is wrestling with a lack of diversity in its Oscar nominations. Nate Parker says that the Oscar issue is just a symptom of a much wider problem.
I feel the injury every day that's happening in America, whether it be socially, you know, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. I mean, there's just so many names. And I felt at some point, I have to live a legacy that addresses that for my children. So when my kids say, man, in 2016, there were a lot of things happening, Dad, like, what were you doing? I can say, you know what, I was addressing it with my talent, you know, with my tool, using my ammo, which is film, to address issues that I felt needed attention.
Armie Hammer says that Parker's passion for the project carried the cast and crew through some very difficult times.
You could feel his passion bleeding out of him while we were doing this. You know, everybody else would be getting tired. Everybody else would be uncomfortable with the subject matter, which at some points in the film gets heavier, you know. But he would be there unwavering, just the perfect leader for the project, really.
The film received several standing ovations at its premiere in Park City, Utah. Fox Searchlight Pictures has paid a record $17.5 million for the distribution rights. That's $7 million more than the previous Sundance record for Little Miss Sunshine. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We will see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply alarmed by reports, including those from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, of serious human rights violations and abuses in Burundi, including eyewitness reports of mass graves, a sharp increase in alleged enforced disappearances and torture, and reports of sexual violence by security forces. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said these and other reports further underscore the urgent need for the government of Burundi to allow for the immediate full deployment and unimpeded access of African Union human rights observers to investigate these allegations. It is imperative that the government of Burundi remove all bureaucratic and practical roadblocks it has used to prevent the AU human rights and military observers from fulfilling their mandate for the past 6 months to investigate reports of violence committed by any side in the conflict. The United States, said Mr. Toner, calls upon the government of Burundi to permit an immediate, impartial investigation into these recent allegations and to hold accountable all those found responsible for crimes. The United States remains concerned about Burundi's ongoing political and humanitarian crisis and the resulting suffering it has brought to the people of Burundi. We once again call on all parties to reject unlawful violence and reiterate that the only way to resolve the crisis gripping the country is for all parties to agree promptly to engage in internationally mediated, inclusive dialogue without preconditions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.